session number 21626, Rule 3.
Americans Rule 3.
And unless you've got this relationship, then I don't know. It must have been very nasty. You'd got to rely on each other, and there were times when you were frightened to death, but. In the morning, say, right, we're going up this road. So particularly when we're in Holland, for example, when you were on a road and there were dykes either side, no way off, you were the leading tank, and you just drove up until, just wait for somebody to shoot at you. Frightened to death. But you couldn't be frightened all the time. Eventually, you just can't be frightened all the time. And eventually you become a fatalist, and that's the only way you can exist. If you didn't feel well, sad, if anything happens, it happens. You just went bomb happy, and quite a lot did. I mean, there were quite a lot who went funny.
That incident you described, where the tank commander disobeyed the order, which country did that occur in?
I think it would be either, I don't remember, it'd be the end of France or beginning of Belgium, perhaps somewhere there. But because of this relationship we'd got, I mean, which is why I say it's so different from what they tried to teach you and all the rubbish that the army tried. I mean, we fought, and although I say it, we fought as well as anybody in our tank. And we came right through. But, I mean, there weren't any discipline in our tank at all. I mean, we called the tank commander, we called him Hog, and he called us by our names.
His name was Hog?
Well, we called him Hog. His name was Ray, but we called him Hog. That was his nickname. I mean, if he did things that we didn't agree with, we told him so, and in no uncertain terms, and in soldier's language,
What rank did he have?
A sergeant, he was the troop sergeant,
What was this tank called?
I can't remember. That's one thing that I can't remember.
Can you remember what your firefly was called?
No. And everybody's asked me that, and I just can't remember. And if you read through all the books, you'll find that they've all got different names for it. I'll mention that again when we talk about the picture.
Maybe I can go back and ask some questions, please, about Normandy.
Right.
What rank did you have at the time?
Oh, trooper. I was trooper all the way through. I, as I told you, I knew I wanted to be a good soldier, and I've never had, after that, I never had any ambition at all about rising up through the ranks. All I was concerned was keep my head down, get out of trouble, because, frankly, you were frightened of getting into trouble. I mean, that's how they ruled in the army. They ruled by fear. There's no doubt about it. But if you were clever, you could you could overcome it and not take any notice of the big bullies and whatnot, you know. And eventually, a fairly comfortable going on. Yes, so I never aspired to be anything other than a trooper or a civilian.
Why do you think you were such a good shot? Was there something that you... Was there a technique which you adopted?
No. It must have been a bit natural, I think. I don't know.
Where did you aim at?
Well, you didn't. You aimed off. Depending on the speed they were moving and various things that I'd learned. Yes, I learned something, and I told you I did enjoy learning when it was important to learn.
When you fired those 5 practice shots in England, how did that go?
I can't remember even if I hit the target. In fact, I don't remember what we were firing at. I'm sorry, but
I wonder if I could ask you, please, to go through the whole incident, starting off with the night advance, up to the German counterattack, and when your tank got hit. Could you just take me through it again, so I can get the picture clear? But don't go from notes, just go from memory, as you did before. But if you, would it be possible, please, to repeat it?
Yeah. We started off by lining up and just starting off in line ahead. And as I say, we were somewhere about the 4th troop or something in the line. So we were virtually in reserve. We weren't at the front. We didn't know what to expect, and we just sat, as I say, with nothing to do. In fact, it was wireless silence, and we weren't supposed to have the wireless sign, but we did, in fact. I was a gunner, but my wireless operator turned the radio into, and we got Vera Lynn singing, "This is a Lovely Way to Spend an Evening." So we were listening to the radio for a start off anyway, until things really arted up and the noise started and the guns started and bear in mind that nothing happened to us on the march, but it did to some of them. I mean, some of them got knocked out and whatnot and had a lot more exciting journey than we had. We just went and followed the tank in front of us as best we could, and all this was going on around us, but nothing actually happened to us until we arrived at this village, which was our target, and it was getting on for morning, and I don't remember a terrific lot about it, but we went through the village, and I believe there was some fighting in the village. But again, we weren't involved, not my actual tank. And we pulled through the village into the orchards and looked out, and there we were on top of a ridge, and you could see this valley going down in front of us, with a road running along the top, which was the main Carnfillers road. And we just sat in the orchards. It took them a long while to sort the regiments and the troops out into the positions that we were going to take, the defensive positions. And by the time we'd got that done and sorted out and whatnot, it, it were getting on a bit. And again, we just sat, nothing was happening at all. It was all quiet. And somebody said, how about some breakfast? So we did, we started and got out and started to cook our breakfast and whatnot. And then sometime later on in the morning, somebody says, there's some tigers. Of course, we all immediately got back into our tanks and into our positions. And I saw these three tiger tanks coming across the front of us.
From left to right?
Yeah, from left to right. And they were at that stage about 1,200 yards away. They said, well, the officer said, we'll wait until they get to 800. So when they moved further forward, eventually my, it'd be Sergeant Gordon, said target the rear tiger, which I did, got on, and then he gave the order to fire, and we fired, and he gave the order to fire again, because immediately you fire, the operator loads you up again. And we fired a second shot, and he started to burn. Not very much, but it did start to burn. I remember seeing the smoke and burn coming up. The commander told the driver to reverse, and we did. We started reversing back into the orchard, and as we did, I could see the gun from the second tiger coming round, because it was facing that way across, and it came round onto us. And I saw a puff as he fired. I don't know whether he fired once, twice, or what. Bear in mind that we were bouncing up and down a bit, and you know, you've got your periscope, as a gunner, you're limited to vision, certainly. Anyway, we went back, and the next thing I knew was that Sergeant Gordon was out the tank. As I say, they said afterwards that it could have been that the shell hit the turret lid, or it could have been that the turret lid got hit by a tree and that it had come down and hit him on the head. I don't know. It may have been that, it may not, I don't know. He may have just decided to get out for all I know. Anyway, he wasn't there. And the next thing was that the officer jumped out of his tank and came across and took control of my tank, because my tank was the only one that was very good. the only one that could do anything. The other three tanks were absolutely useless, you see, because they were too far away. I believe that they were shooting at him, I don't know. But they couldn't do very much damage. So he took charge, and we pulled out again and targeted in the second tank, and I fired one shot at them, and he went up as well. They said afterwards, because the next day it appears some of the officers went and had a look round and saw what had happened, and they said that we'd actually knocked his turret off. Anyway, we reversed back quick under cover again, and I saw the one that was in front was milling around and was now turned more this way a bit. But we pulled out again, and I fired two at him, and he went up. And then it was quiet. So we pulled back into cover again. As I say, all this had happened in about 12 minutes. And we pulled back into cover and just sat there. I don't think anybody knew, again, what were happening. Which again, you know, I don't understand as why they didn't know we were going to be counterattacked or what we're going to count. I mean, we'd been there a long time. They should have known what the Germans had got by then. But anyway, we sat there and suddenly somebody reported that a lot of tanks were coming in from the left. And as we sat there, we saw so we took up a new position. We were facing that way. We took up a new position, turning around a bit and facing the other way. And we saw these infantry coming up the ridge in front of us. Because although when we were looking out to the right, the valley was shallow, as it went round, it got deep. Which is one of the reasons why the Germans knocked so many of our tanks out, because it appears, and I only know this from reading about it later, that one of them got into that valley where he couldn't be seen and just sat there and picked us off one after the other. But anyway, these infantry were coming up this ridge towards us, about 200 yards in front of us, I suppose. And, we gave them a couple of bursts and they disappeared. And after a few minutes, we saw in the distance, and this was at 1200 yards, this one was coming towards us. And I shot at him and knocked him out at 1200 yards. And then we sat back again and we just sat there and just sat there until they shot us. And all of a sudden there was a big bang and sparks were flying all around the turret and whatnot. And the officer said, everybody out. And as I say, after making sure that the gun went over the turrets, and we all jumped out. I think the officer got out first, and then I think it was the operator who was next to him, you see, and then the gun, me coming out the gunner's, had to get out the gunner's seat and out, and landed in the field, and there were bullets and whatnot flying about, and although I don't think I took enough. I'm really frightened then, really frightened. All I thought about was get out up the field, you know. And we did. We all ran up the field and towards the orchard, towards back towards the village. And as I say, I understand that the officer went over to report to the squadron leader and got wounded on the way over. But I don't know. I've never seen him or any of the crew since.
What was the officer's name?
I can't remember offhand. Never mind. But I can find out. So that was that. And then, as I say, we lost a lot of tanks, so there were a lot of spare crews, park crews and whatnot, and they brought some more tanks up from somewhere, and they made up new crews, and we started off again the next day, and they made me an operator.
But not in a Firefly?
Oh no, no. I don't think they brought any more Fireflies up though. I think they were all just ordinary Shermans. I don't think they got any more Fireflies at that stage.
Do you remember the names of your tank crew?
I remember the names of my new tank crew, but I don't remember the names of the Firefly tank crew. Now, bear in mind that I wasn't with them for all that long because we only got the Firefly a month before D-Day, and they made up, they didn't put me and all my original crew in the Firefly. They made up from various things. They made up new crews for some reason. Again, I never understood why, but they did. So I weren't with them for very long, and I'm afraid I've got an awful memory, and frankly, after the war, I tried to forget everything anyway. So I don't remember them, but I do remember all the names of my new crew.
Can you give those?
Yeah, I mean, it was Ray Ely was the tank commander. Bill Arm was the gunner. Smudge Smith, now I can't remember his first name, but Smudge Smith was the driver, and Mickey Toll was the co-driver. And I was the gunner, the operator, of course. And we stayed together right the way through until the end of the war.
What was the date and place of the incident?
August the 8th. St. Agnes. St. Agnian de Cramersnil.
And can you tell me the story of the painting then, please, now?
Yes, can I just finish
the
rest of the war?
Okay.
As I said, we then went in all the march through Holland and Belgium. We were in the Le Havre. They bypassed Le Havre, and they brought us back to clear it out. And I saw I believe it was a 1,000 bomber raid from 2 miles, which is something I'll never forget. So I just left this one pocket of Germans, and we'd all gone on, and they came back to do it. And before we went in, they I'm sure it was a 1,000 bomber raid they put on it. Certainly a hell of a lot of bombers. And to see all them bombers coming in was a sight to, you know, never forget.
How did you feel about it?
Very happy at that time. By now it was a matter of kill before you get killed. I'm afraid. We didn't know the things that we know now. If we had done, we'd have felt even more. But it was purely the fact that you knew that they were going to shoot at you if you didn't shoot at them by now. So then we did that, and we went, as I say, right the way through until it came to the Meuse, to the Rhine. And for the Rhine, they took our tanks away and gave us buffaloes. And we did the Rhine crossing at Essen. But that meant we had a month on the Meuse training, which was quite pleasurable, trying to find out at what angle you could drive a buffalo along a bank without turning it over. Unfortunately, one or two went a bit too far. But we did a month with driving buffaloes over the Meuse in the middle of the night, you know, ready for, as I say, the Rhine. And then we moved up to the Rhine and did the Rhine crossing. And then oh, wait a minute, now I've missed something out, haven't I? I've missed out the Ardennes. Before we were we went to the Mersa. We were in Holland. We'd gone up. We'd taken the route through Belgium into Holland, and about the same time as the Arnhem farce. When I say that, I don't think anybody knew what was happening. I mean, that, you know, was such a fiasco, wasn't it? That it's unbelievable. We were up in Holland, and then all of a sudden, of course, came the other fiasco, the Ardennes fiasco. I mean, again, you know, how they could not know that the Germans were strong enough to counterattack and nearly get through to Amsterdam, which if they had done, we could easily have won the war, I suppose. How that could happen without anybody knowing anything about it after all this time we'd been planning the war. It's so unbelievable. Anyway, we were up there, and all of a sudden we'd got a rush straight down to the Ardennes. Now, normally, on that sort of thing, you'd do it on tank transporters. You didn't do 400 or 500 miles on driving your tank before you went into action. But because it was such a farce, and there were no plans or anything, we had to drive all the way down from Holland, right the way down to Namur in Belgium, which was, I'll tell you another little story. It was so cold, it was unbelievable, really, really cold. That it was New Year's, so at Christmas when it happened, so unbelievably cold. We were driving down these roads, coming down from Holland all the way down to Nimes, and travelling at not very fast speed because we were in convoy and all the rest of it. And it was so cold sitting in the tank that Bullarmy, who was the gunner, said, "Sod this, I'm going to get out and walk." So he got out and started walking inside the tank, you see. And all of a sudden, the column speeded up for some reason. And we left Bill behind. And there he was walking on the road, and we were all waving to him. Well, we didn't see him for 2 days. And he eventually caught up with us. But that was the sort of atmosphere that we were in at that time. We, you know, nobody.
Did you feel sorry for him?
No, not a bit. I mean, he'd have done the same to me if he'd have got the opportunity. If you could take the rise out of him, you did. And I mean, it wasn't any good the sergeant saying, bringing his military discipline in to do anything. You know, we'd proved that we were good soldiers right the way through the war without all the rubbishy stuff. But, you know, that's the sort of thing. Well, then we got down the Ardennes, and it was about over by the time we got there. We went to a place called Cini. And as soon as you got there, when if it were not in the actual fighting situation, then you knocked on somebody's door and said, "Can we sleep here for the night?" You know, and you put your bed down on the front room floor, and we did that at a house in Cini, and we slept on the floor, and we slept there for one night, and I still visit those people now. Every year we go and see them. The woman is 92, and in fact, we just heard that she's in hospital. But I've made some of the best friends that I've got with that Belgian family, and we were only there for that time, and the reason was that they'd got three daughters who were ranging from about 7 to 12. There was snow and whatnot on the ground, and there was a hill just outside their house, and I spent the one day we were there pushing those kids up and down the hill in a sled.
How do you spell Cine?
C-I-N-E-Y. And as I say, we still visit them, and they visit us, and their grandchildren visit their grandchildren. One of the one good thing that came out of the war, as far as I'm concerned. So that was